Before we get started, I hope you'll celebrate with me that I've got two new great sponsors because I know they're going to be useful to you if you're building a business. The first is 99 Designs. They're the largest crowdsourced design company. And the best way to explain what they do is to tell you that I recently used them when I needed a template designed. And what I did was I described on 99designs.com what my ideal template needed to have. Next day, I got a batch of designs. I gave them all feedback, all the designers who created it. Day after that, I got a new batch of designs. I gave them feedback again. Next day, I had a new batch of designs. I finally picked the perfect one for me, and that's the one that I paid for. 99 Designs even let me pick the price that I paid. And you're going to be blown away by how many options you have. But if you don't like any of them, 99 Designs guarantees, and you don't have to pay for any of them. Check out 99design.com. Second company is DNA Mail. If you're running a business, you'd be a fool to also try to manage your own Microsoft Exchange server. I know because I was that fool taking on too much when it came to my email system. Let DNA Mail take care of it. They're going to guarantee uptime. They're going to give you 24/7 support. You can call up somebody in Los Angeles where I was recently living, not in a foreign country, not limited to a certain number of hours. You get all the support that you need so that you can collaborate with calendars, tasks, contacts, make sure your email is dependable, and so much more. And if you need Google Apps, they take care of you with that too. DNAmail.com. Finally, you already know about Grasshopper, the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. I've been talking here about how I have a Grasshopper phone number so I could be reached no matter where I am in the world, so I can have extensions, so I can have all the features that I need. Grasshopper.com will do the same thing for you. Check them out. Here's the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And today I've got with me a guest who was so popular the first time he was here on Mixergy that I invited him back. The guest is Jason Cohen. He's the founder of Smart Bear Software, the makers of the peer code review tool, Code Collaborator. And the first time he was on here, we talked about how he launched the company, bootstrapped it, built it up, how he sold it. And that's the interview that was just so great that I said, how do I find a way to get this guy back on here so that I can have more enthusiastic viewers of Mixergy? He also blogs about startups at asmartbear.com. That's asmartbear.com. And he's a mentor at Capital Factory, which is an early stage accelerator program for tech startups. Now, here's a stat that will explain to you why I invited him here to talk about how to increase conversions. 50% of the people who get a demo of his software at Smart Bear Software end up buying. That's 50%, one out of two people who get the demo end up being customers. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. All right, so I want to know how you do that. More importantly, I want to know how people in our audience can do that. And I thought maybe we could start with why. Why trial instead of just getting people to buy right away?
Well, I think nowadays people are trained that they're allowed to have a trial. They're trained that they're allowed to try something for free and see if they want it before they plunk down a credit card. And I appreciate that with stuff like the iTunes Store, that's not true. You don't get to try it. I also think that people don't like that. So if you don't have a free trial, you're just throwing up a barrier. Now, there's an argument that the people who open their wallet anyway are going to be the higher quality people that you want to spend your time with. Their pain will be more acute. They probably have the money and so on. And I agree with that. But for example, the software that we're selling is collaborative. It takes more than one person for it to be useful. So, you know, imagine someone at a company like Adobe, who's one of our customers. Imagine them going through the Adobe purchasing process for one or two or three seats of our software before they could even see if they wanted it. That's never, ever going to happen. It's really hard to go through that. So I would say that the more difficult your software is to install, or if your customers are at a place where purchasing is hard, you can't possibly expect them to do that before they even know what it is or they've just seen screenshots. On the other hand, something that's kind of popular now is you run the credit card first and then you say, but we have a whatever 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, like if you're inundated with people using your stuff and trialing your stuff, and you can't even keep up with the tech support, and most people are full of it and really aren't going to buy and are wasting your time, then I get that technique. So 37signals is exactly in that category, right? They have such good lead generation, inbound stuff, that they don't need to muck around with free trials. And besides, there's free freemium style as well, which is kind of the same thing. But that's not what most startup founders, that's not the situation most startup founders are in. Most of them are, oh my God, someone came to my website and downloaded. Sweet. I hope someone does that tomorrow too. And if that's the case, which it usually is, I don't see how you can throw up barriers like, oh, and you throw in a credit card. Well, now you're going from one to zero on the most days. And that's just not acceptable. You can't stem the tide of potential users with that. So it's a pretty significant barrier, especially bigger companies, but even if you're just an average person, to whip out your credit card before you're even allowed to see what it is.
I see. All right. And we're actually later on in the conversation going to be talking about feedback, how to get it and the importance of it, how to do it right. And I can understand that if you're giving away your software, you can get better feedback that will improve the paid version of the software too. So if we're going to offer a trial, what's the best way to present it?
Well, I mean, it depends on the type of customer. So for example, if you have a web app and you're selling to end users, then the simplest possible thing is definitely the right thing. No credit cards, log in using Facebook or something, because everyone's got Facebook now and so forth. Nothing new, nothing they haven't seen before, grease it in. On the other hand, if it's SmartBear taking the other end of the extreme, we're selling 5- and 6-figure software packages to larger companies. Logging in with Facebook is maybe even a deterrent, because maybe they don't have it, they don't want to, certainly the company doesn't have it. That's all crap. And so instead, of course, making it easy to download, and or if you have to download and try it is obviously key. But I would say the thing is to keep the line of communication open after that trial has started is actually the key thing. Because what happens is people download or they log in, and if you're lucky, 5% of them ever come back and do anything, talk to tech support, God forbid, actually purchase the thing. But like the vast, vast majority will never, ever talk to you again. And to me, that's kind of the low-hanging fruit part of this equation. It's what is going on to where this person said they found you, they clicked on your AdWord, or they saw some article, or they looked at your homepage. That was kind of cool. They looked at your screenshots. That's sort of interesting. They looked at your pricing page. That's in my realm. Then they went to the download. Should I download it or should I sign in? Do I want to? They went through that process, and they looked at your tool, and they used it or didn't use it, and then they left. That's a lot of stuff for them to do. That's a lot of investment they made in you to then leave. And to me, that's really interesting, and to me, that's where a lot of low-hanging fruit is. And getting that conversion rate from the conversion rate of just them talking to you at all from 5% to 10% or to 15%, that can really transform your bottom line revenue, because you can capture the reasons that they left. Because the reasons are everything from, I couldn't get it installed. I got installed, but I couldn't figure out how to do the thing I was trying to do. I signed up, but there were some menu items. I didn't know what it was, so I left. Or I did try to use it, but I didn't realize that it did what I wanted because I was, because I didn't find it. Or maybe it all works and the budget's just not right. Or whatever. Like, it could be many things. Of course, those are just some obvious examples, but you will never know. So how are you supposed to fix it? And in lead generation, like trying to get people to hit your website in the first place, it's now ingrained in us. We got to do A/B tests. We need measurability and metrics. We have to surface that all the time, and we need to constantly drive those forward, and et cetera. Of course. But at this stage, the stage where that worked, they came in, and now you're trying to get them to – you're just trying to figure out what's going on here. I feel like we lack that completely, and that people don't talk about it that much. So you have people talking about user experience, user interfaces, trying not to confuse people. And that's fine. What are you doing for the number of people who are coming in right now and abandoning, even though they showed all this interest? I think that's where some juicy fruit is.
I see. You're saying that a lot of the thought today is in how to get people to the site and how to get more of those people to take some kind of action to try the software in this case. But once they've tried it, we're saying to the user, okay, you probably are now going to love it so much that you're going to come back here and buy it from me. And that's where we're wasting a lot of opportunity.
I think so. I mean, generally speaking, if you spend more money in AdWords, if you spend more money on newsletters, you can get a number of people to click through and another number to download your stuff. And you should optimize that, et cetera. Okay, we know that. But I know a lot of companies who get hundreds of downloads a day and one purchase a week. In other words, it's clear that that part of the of trying to close somebody or trying to sell someone is extremely leaky. And traditionally, it's difficult to find out why, because with A/B tests, it's easy because you can just see this was clicked more. With getting to the download form, it's relatively easy because there are, you know, there's web analytics tools. So like we've gotten a lot smarter about the sort of external metrics and on-site metrics in getting people driven to a download page. But between that download or web app trial and PayPal, I feel like there we don't have this wide array of tools and techniques and people talking about it. And by the way, I don't think you need a lot of tools. I have a lot of suggestions for how to do this, which I'm, of course we'll talk about. And almost none of them have to do with any kind of magical tool. But I feel like we're neglecting that. And now that we're good on the front end, or relatively good, or relatively intelligent about lead generation on the front end, I think it's time to focus on this sort of trial to purchase conversion part of the process. Yeah.
Okay, and I see Mike B in the audience is asking, how do you get the users to answer all those questions? We're going to get to that. All right, so let's talk about then what's the first thing. We've gotten them to try it. What do we do now? Or actually, sure, you're probably going to tell us what to do before they even get to try, right?
Well, there's a lot of different things. So since someone just asked, how do you get them to talk to you at all? That's a great question, so let's start there. So the one thing you know is that they're looking at your app at some point, and then they leave. So let's take the example of a downloaded application. So a lot of people have a help menu, and in it there's something that says feedback, dot, dot, dot. And it opens an email client, or it's a dialog box, or it goes to some kind of contact us web page. And nobody uses that, right? Because it's buried in how, you know, you see feedback, and it's just not what you do. When you try software and you don't like it, you don't go to the feedback link. That's not what happens. You just leave, right? Or most people do. It doesn't really invite feedback. I know one founder who just changed that word from feedback to bitch at us. It literally said bitch at us. Just the fact that you're obviously a human being and trying to make it a little more obvious that you want the feedback helped. But that's still not good enough because it's still buried somewhere, right? You need to prompt them. So one of the sort of typical things you do with downloaded software trials is you have nag screens. And typically you're nagging to say, you only have 12 days left. You only have 50 uses left. Did you know that I'm about to watermark whatever you just made? You know, stuff like that, the nag screen. So my suggestion is this. Nag screens are fine, but you know everyone kind of expects to be nagged for nag to buy the software. But if they're just starting out, or especially if they didn't want it, the nag is not enough. They're not buying it yet. They're really going to buy probably once that time expires. And you know that because if you've done applications like this with a large enough scale, you know that when you create a new release, whatever the trial period is, like 2 weeks, that's when you get another lump of sales. Like it's the first day and the last day of the trial that you get your lump of sales. You know they're not really buying in the middle that much. So I say, can you use that nag screen as an excuse to get that feedback? So there was a guy, and his name is Chris, and I forget his last name. I talked to him at this year's South by Southwest, and he used this technique. He put in his, when you quit the application, when you exit, a nag screen pops up and says, hey, what did you think? Now, the person might have liked the app. They might not. You know, they might have quit because they're about to uninstall it. It says, what do you think? And there's a big box. And when they say, okay, I think it sent an email, but it might have done a web post to a form. I don't know, but whatever, right? And he went from knowing nothing about people who are trialing and essentially nothing about what they're doing to he got 10 to 20 responses a day just because he nagged them and asked proactively. So, you know, in your nag screen, probably not at the beginning of the app, right, because they don't know yet, but probably when they quit, that's smarter. Not just something in the help menu. And when you do it, you got to act like you mean it, not just, we want to hear from you, snore. That's what everybody says. Microsoft says that too, but I don't believe those Vista ads, do you? Like, you know, actually make it look like you want to hear about it and then prompt them for it. And it works.
Okay. Let's talk about beforehand. I know that you're a big proponent of getting people on a mailing list, that in order to get people to even take your trial, you should get their email address and get them to sign up for a mailing list.
Yeah.
Have you done tests to see if requesting the email address is enough of a barrier that people leave and without downloading, yeah, without even trying?
That is a terrific question. So obviously, if you could collect information from the user before they download, like their email, their name, their company, their phone number, and their date of birth, and all that crap, clearly the more information you have, you can make the better decisions about marketing, you can reach out to them later, and so on. But everyone argues you can't do that because it's a barrier. If someone sees a form, they go, oh my God, and they leave. That's what everyone says. So at SmartBear, we tried. We did an A-B test with our download page, just like you're supposed to do. And we made a little form, and the form had email address, name, company, and phone number. They were all optional. All of them were optional. We didn't say whether they were optional or not. They just were. Okay. So really, if you wanted to put garbage or nothing, you actually can. And of course, we A/B tested this with no form at all blocking you getting to the download page. There was zero change in number of downloads. Zero. Now, to be fair, again, you have to consider our audience is a B2B audience, right? These are people at a company. And also solves a pain. This isn't a pleasure thing. Like, this isn't, trying to get a game on the iPhone where they just want to play the game. They're not trying to solve a particular pain. They're not trying to save money. This isn't a business proposition. So, number one, this is at SmartBear, it's a business proposition. Number two, it's corporate. And so I could absolutely believe that in other contexts, it might be different. So obviously, the real recommendation is you should at least A/B test it. You have no excuse not to test it. Also, how about test just email and that's it? Just give yourself a hook, right? Or another one that I find incredibly useful is you put a field in there that says, how did you hear about us? Now, I'm shoehorning this in because we're talking about conversions and this isn't about conversions, but still, we did that too. We put an optional fill in the blank, not drop down, of how did you hear about us? And it was fantastically useful. People filled it in 90% of the time. It was incredible. So that's not about conversions, but still you have to do that to inform your marketing choices. But anyway, so we found people just did it. And so, of course, once you have that, you can ask them, how's it going, and blah, 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 and revive things. Oh, I forgot about the trial, which is all the time. Like half the time people just say, yeah, I downloaded it. I forgot to get back to it. And you can just prompt them to get back to it. It's very easy. Now, another thing is you put a little checkbox that says, do you want to be in our newsletter? Our newsletter has tips and articles and crap, and of course you can unsubscribe and we're really nice people and we won't send you spam and all the usual crap people say about newsletters. And again, we put this box on there and I forget the exact number, 70 or 80% of people say you can send me the newsletter, which I find ridiculous that large number of people want the damn newsletter. I guess people are accustomed to being able to unsubscribe or block stuff if they don't want it. And I don't know. I honestly cannot tell you exactly why the rate's so high. But let me tell you why that's interesting. Because, I mean, you hear the usual social media arguments for newsletters because you're staying top of mind. You know all that already. That's old news. So here's something that I'm sure will surprise you. It surprised the crap out of me. So at SmartBear, our newsletter has, I think, 40,000 people subscribe to it, okay? All opt in like this. And I assumed that almost all of them were customers. Because why the hell else would you want a newsletter that comes out every 6 weeks talking about peer code review? My God, like, you can't possibly be, like, that interested in it unless you're a customer, right? And, you know, it's got product releases and, you know, meet people who work at SmartBear. Why would you want to know this if you're not a customer? Okay. So we did this thing where we called it 5 for 5. When we came out with version 5.0 about a year ago, we sent out a message to our newsletter that says, you can buy 5 seats of our product code collaborator for $5. 1 week only, but tell your friends, there's no limit. I think it was limit like 1 per group or something, so people wouldn't buy 100 of them, right? So I figured, you know, maybe we get a couple of people forwarding this to friends at other companies or something. 250 people off the newsletter bought it, five for five. And we did a little follow-up to find out who the hell they were. They were all people who read the newsletter normally. Well, aren't you customers? Well, no, you know, we trialed it, and you know, there was one reason or another that they didn't buy it. Maybe they didn't have a budget. Maybe they just couldn't get off their ass. Maybe the project they were going to do it for stopped. Maybe, you know, whatever. There was whatever the reason was. And so when they saw it, when they saw this offer appear in the newsletter, they thought, oh, well, I can certainly, you know, I can run $5 for anything. I'll go ahead and buy it so we have it. Or some of them said, I went ahead and bought it so that I could have an extended trial period. In other words, an infinite trial period as long as only five people were using it. Like it was an excuse to get an infinitely long trial period. Anyway, bottom line is, like, all these people read the newsletter that were not paying customers and now are paying customers. And here's the brilliant part. Because they're paying customers, we do have all of their contact information and permission to talk to them, right? Like, they had to pay us, so clearly we have their contact information, right? And, it, you know, it's totally normal for people of software you bought to send you an email twice a year and just say, how's it going, right?
Yeah.
So with complete permission and, you know, there's nothing underhanded or bad about it at all, we got a ton of people who you could call it trial users or I don't know what you want to call it, but we got this incredible reaction because we had a newsletter of people on the download form. And that's why I'm trying to tie it all back to that. And obviously that's just one example of what you can use a newsletter for, but clearly dripping a newsletter into people who haven't bought, besides an offer. But I mean, there's lots of other things, like when you have a new release, maybe there's a feature that makes them go, that sounds cool, maybe I'll try that again, right? Like clearly there's lots of things you can do in a newsletter to, you know, to capitalize on that attention. Again, stuff you've probably heard already though. But that one, you know, an interesting offer that gets people to become customers that you can then talk to. Again, going back to the caller's question, how do you get them to talk to you? You know, that worked great. So the newsletter really makes a big difference, and for us, didn't impact downloads.
Okay. Do you think, by the way, that you can do that on everything? Does it have to just be, if it didn't impact your downloads of the software, could you use it for, how about this? Your blog posts are incredibly long and detailed. They're like full-on reports. Instead of calling them a blog post, could you call some of these longer ones reports and request people's email address in order to show it to them?
Oh, yeah, and people do, right? They'll make a state of the Twitter report, or they'll make a, I have 10 tips for how to increase software conversions or something, right? And they'll say, look, it's completely free. Just sign up for the newsletter and you got it, and you can unsubscribe or whatever, but yeah, people use that as an excuse to get an email. Some bloggers do this even just with content that's not even special report. They just say there's a blog and there's a newsletter, and you might want to subscribe to both. You might just want to subscribe to one. The newsletter comes out monthly, and it's got a couple of things, and so if that's the level of engagement you want with me, you should sign up for the newsletter. If you want to hear from me five times a week, you should subscribe to the blog. And I guess if you want to hear from me five times a day, you should subscribe to my Twitter feed, right? Or Tumblr or something. So I think people already use those things differently. Like clearly a newsletter shouldn't be too frequent unless you really are a news outlet or something.
Right.
But yeah, as a tool to allow people to engage with you in an amount of time that they choose, it's clearly good.
I was amazed by Photo Jojo that way, that they really are a blog, but they got my email address instead of getting me to sign up on my Google Reader or trying to remember to come back, because they emphasize the email registration way, they emphasize it over every other option. It was just really featured there. All right, now I understand you're sending them five for five. You're giving them an incredible price, $1 per seat of your software. $5 is nothing. I understand that would work. What else do you do with them on the newsletter to increase conversions, to get them to stay in touch, to get them to give you feedback?
Well, there's lots of stuff. So what you're doing, if you're talking to people who haven't bought in a newsletter, the question is, what could you do to get them back off their ass and try it again or think about it again or reconsider it or whatever it was that they didn't buy before? Of course, you could also ask them why they didn't. I'm not sure if that would work because that's so cold at that point, as opposed to when the previous example where it was in the product, where they just experienced the thing, right? But here's some things. So anytime you have even a minor software release, you can talk about the cool new thing that you can now do, because that might prompt something to go, oh, that sounds really neat. Maybe I should give another look. Second thing is, a lot of times software has features which are not prominent or obvious if you're a casual user or the first-time user, but they're there, and you know, perhaps you should reconsider and put those things more foremost, but sometimes you just can't. Like, sometimes it just doesn't make sense to throw that in people's face. But the fact that you can do it, so a great example in Photoshop, for example, is the cool thing about Photoshop is not that there are layers or that there's this tool. It's that if you use a combination of do this and then pick this filter and then change the mask to that, do this other thing, look at this weird effect you can make. Like, that's kind of part of the cool part of Photoshop. You can't just make that thing prominent, like on the front page when you get into Photoshop. It doesn't make sense. But that is part of the fun and interesting thing of Photoshop that gets people to say, I want to learn this tool so I can do that. So in that case, that's something you can put in a newsletter. Look at this tip. Not just a tip like, did you know, but you know, something cool like, look at this neat effect. We're going to tell you how to do this with our tool. Don't you want to be able to do this? Right? So that there's a way where you can highlight something really neat and not obvious that might people go, I didn't realize you could do that. Well, maybe I should look, right? Another one is a truly compelling customer success story. So not just like a cold case study and not just like a one-line testimonial. It was great. It saved us a lot of money, snore. But like a good story of, you know, yeah, you know, they made us outsource this stuff and that really sucked. But then we started using this tool. And because of these three specific things, this happened. And it's really neat, and I would totally recommend that if you have this problem with remote developers, that maybe you give this a look. You know, something like that, maybe a couple of paragraphs. That could maybe somebody could identify with that, especially if it's told from the customer's point of view and it's not clearly a marketing sell. You know, that could maybe encourage people. Another thing that's kind of fun is you can highlight blog posts elsewhere on the internet in your newsletter. And that, of course, gives you some kudos with that blogger. Maybe he'll even talk about you, which is sort of some free marketing. So that's kind of a nice side effect. But also, again, you know, people might be swayed more by someone else's words than your words. And so by doing that, maybe you can get people to think again about your topic. So for us, we don't reference bloggers who are talking about our tool. That's too salesy and direct. We find someone who talked about code review and how it was really useful, or they had this neat technique, or they wanted to talk specifically about how they did it with Ruby and cucumber tests or something. And we highlight that, and so a reader might say, oh, I use Ruby and cucumber tests. I'm going to read this. And again, since it's not our voice, maybe it's more compelling. Again, like, that's a sideways way to sort of develop your social media you know, presence a little, or connections a little, and convince people. The coupon thing, like 5 for 5 or something like that, I guess that's kind of obvious. And the last thing that we'll say, we're going to be in Kansas City.
Well, hang on a second. Let's let the video catch up. In fact, while it's catching up on your side, I'll say that Balsamic Val is in the audience. One of the things that I love about Balsamic is they give away their software to people who then end up writing about it. And because they just got this free software, they get excited about it and they write reviews, I think, that consider the software much more than the average Amazon reviewer or the average reviewer in general. So it looks like the video caught up. Hey Val, sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah, we love Balsamic. Yeah, so the last thing is just when you are going to make a sales call in a city, you can use that to reach out to a lot of people to say, look, we're going to be here. If you're going to be here, let us know. We'll swing by. Even if it's just for 15 minutes to say hello, let's do it. And, you know, a lot of times we'll do that and get a huge response. And so, you know, we can really make the most of a trip because obviously trips are expensive and they're very valuable, but they're expensive. And so if you can cram a lot of visits in, and this is a way to develop that, that's pretty handy.
I've heard you say that you should also call up customers and get feedback from them. Have you called up customers at your business?
Oh, all the time.
How do you do it? You just find somebody who bought, you get their phone number, you give them a ring, and you do what?
Yeah, so, I mean, I usually start with email because at least our customers don't usually like the phone. Mm-hmm. So you have to pick the media that you think is appropriate for your customers, right? We sell to software developers, so obviously they don't want to talk on the phone. And really, when I say call up, I don't like talking on the phone either, actually. So it's kind of a a metaphor for talking to them, right? It's actually pretty easy. You know, imagine that, you know, whatever thing you bought, let's say you're, you know, whenever you buy software from a small company, you kind of know that. You know that it's from a small company. If you get an email that says, we're actually trying to figure out how to make the product better. We have these ideas on our roadmap. Does this sound like it would be useful to you? What things bother you and so on? Same kind of stuff that you expect to get out of Git Satisfaction or User Voice, which you can use, by the way. I mean, there's nothing wrong with those things, of course. But prompting someone to do it, I mean, that's never spam. It's never spam for someone really honestly trying to solicit your feedback. And so the people who like to talk are going to talk back. I mean, it's just kind of that simple. It's you don't really need a big excuse. You just say, we're trying to collect stuff. If you want to try to make it a little more exclusive or try to make us build a story around it, you could say, we're trying to build a customer advisory group. And so we're trying to find certain customers who are really interested in giving us feedback. And there's no commitment, like there's no time commitment. You know, don't worry. You know, if you can say yes, and if you feel like never talking to us again, that's fine. But we would like to invite you into it. And, you know, what it means is every blank weeks, you know, we'll have like a webinar, or we, you know, we'll solicit feedback from you. Sometimes we have surveys. I don't know, whatever it is that you want to do. And would you like to be part of our customer advisory group? Now, that sounds pretty neat and exclusive. And again, like you can say there's no commitment, but the fact that they're on that list, which maybe you could even publish, which is kind of cool, gives them some reputation plus, you know, sort of is psychological reason for them to actually give you feedback and contribute that way.
Do you do and that? Do you know of a company that does that well?
There are, I know a lot of people who have customer advisory boards, which is even more exclusive, where they literally fly people in to sit around a table and talk. Now that's very expensive. It's very valuable, but obviously if you're a bootstrap startup, that's not the kind of thing you're going to do. What I would say is that that's what you're trying to curate out of things like Git Satisfaction and User Voice. Mm-hmm. And they're good, but there's also noise, and it's kind of hard to distinguish a lot of the noise or people who are talking, but how much skin do they really have in it versus people with a little, with one more level of sort of a commitment to actually helping you make a better product.
I see somebody in the audience loves that idea, but he's asking, how do you keep these vocal customers from making noise about issues that don't really matter?
So you can't mute someone. You can't muzzle somebody, right? Mm-hmm. So few ways to deal with it. The 37 signals way is to say, don't worry, we're not listening to anything you say anyway. Like they explicitly say on the forums, we're not listening, so you might as well stop talking. Huh. I don't like that way, but that's a way, right? It's pretty arrogant. So one thing to do for sure is to acknowledge what they're saying, right? Everybody wants to be heard and understood. That's basic human psychology. So the first thing is to say, I hear where you're coming from. I see what you're saying. I see what, you know, why you said that, or maybe you don't. And so that's one way to start engaging, is instead of going immediately to that's wrong or here's why we can't do it, to dig with them. Well, why are you, you know, why do you want to do that? Why do you suppose that's the right way? Are there any other ways we could potentially do that? In other words, stuff that you would do internally in product development, try to do it with them. In other words, try to have them discover for themselves, kind of like the Socratic method, walk them through the Socratic method of, can this really work? Or let's say the reason that you can't do it is it would ruin other people's experience. Uh-huh. So can you tell it to them that way? Like instead of just saying, no, we can't because of other people, can you say, well, look, that's a really interesting idea, but we have this problem. Maybe you can help, right? Maybe you can help because, see, there's other users that are like this. And if they say, well, those people are dumb, you can say, well, maybe, but they're our customers. So help us out here, right? Like we, maybe they are dumb. Maybe you're right, wink. But, you know, but help us out here because we have to keep them happy and we can't retrain them, right? So, you know, that's kind of the bind we're in. It's like we totally understand what you're coming from, but we also have this. So, like, what do you think we should do? In other words, can you throw it back at them to delay the inevitable of having to say we can't do it? And I'm not saying that works all the time, but I've done that a lot. And now I'm kind of lucky because our customers are software developers. And so if we get into the nitty-gritty of here's why this is difficult to implement, or here's why this is risky, here's why this is hard to test, here's why, you know, this doesn't work if you scale to this. I'm lucky in that, you know, our customers can kind of understand that, right? And so obviously the less savvy your customers are in that, the harder it is for them to wrap their head around it, but at least you're engaging with them in a way that respects them and is trying to still include them. And, you know, ultimately you can't muzzle them, but at least you're sort of misdirecting them, or at least making them think about your issues so they don't feel like you're just dismissing them. That's really the problem. If they're just like, well, those guys don't listen, that's a failure that you can get around.
You talked about in one of your blog posts about user voice and get satisfaction as a way of getting feedback. What else are you using to get feedback? What have you seen other people use well?
Yeah, well, forums are a way that a lot of people have used. I mean, again, that's kind of like, they're kind of all this very, very similar, right? What's the line between get satisfaction and traditional forums? You know, one surfaces things, one don't. They're both useful in different ways. So I would say that actually talking one-on-one to people, typically by email, it's not public, but actually that is the highest fidelity way to get feedback. And you can clarify things. And also just the fact that they are willing to interact with you at that level of sort of committing time and energy means that their opinion is at least a little bit more interesting than anonymous postings on public forums or random bitching on Twitter that happens to include your name somewhere so you found it. So although that's not very exciting or social or viral or anything like that, I still think that's actually where a lot of the interesting stuff happens. And I'll say one other thing about that, tech support. Tech support is your front line of talking to customers, many of which are trialing, right? Many of which haven't bought yet. And that is a huge place to get feedback. The role of tech support is not just to get people unstuck or have people reboot the machine or whatever. It's also product development. It's figuring out, wait a minute, they have this problem, but what's the real reason they have this problem? The real reason is because our interface is confusing. The real reason is because the word we use for that in the menu bar didn't connect with them. The real reason is because they're actually trying to do something different. And should we ignore that? Or should we maybe do that different thing too? In other words, tech support is informing this kind of feedback, or it is a conduit for this kind of feedback that's really important. And I think people, again, neglect that. They think of tech support as just get the ticket closed and get them out of there. But I think it can be much more valuable than that.
I see SmartBear Software has a phone number right on the homepage, and I'm seeing a few companies now put that phone number and become accessible. It seems like a very expensive addition to a website to have a phone number and support it all day long. How effective has it been, and how expensive has it been?
It's not expensive at all because most people don't want to use the phone anyway. So you put it on your website, you automatically get the credit. You get more credibility. You look like a real company, right? And for the people who want to use the phone, you're set apart of most companies because most of them don't want to talk to you. The fact is that most people don't call. And yeah, it's true. Sometimes they call and sometimes they just want to talk for an hour about nothing and you sort of feel bad about hanging up on them and it wastes a lot of time. That's true. But the way I look at it is you could always take it down. Like you're afraid that you're going to be inundated with phone calls from people. You should be so lucky to be inundated with phone calls, right? You'll learn a lot from whatever the hell's going on with that. Now, yeah, I know if you're Dell, you can't do that, or you know, you do, but you have tech, you have to have a whole system. But you're not that. I get, you know. So, it's what exactly are you worried about that you'll be talking to customers, potential customers, all day long, and being able to engage them in whatever you want to talk about, and that's bad. You want to not do that.
At what point did you add that onto the site?
Immediate. We always had a phone number.
You always had a phone number up, even when it was pretty much you alone?
Yes. But here's the thing. You don't have to, it doesn't have to be all around the clock. It says we answer at 9 to 5 or something, 9 to 4 or something, central time. And by the way, sometimes we don't anyway, and it goes to voicemail. So, you know, it doesn't have, just because you have a phone number doesn't mean you have to answer it, you know, at 3 a.m. on a Sunday in your time zone. That's not true.
I see. What's the craziest call that you got?
I guess the bad ones are someone doesn't know what we do and is really frustrated because they're trying to do something completely different. We don't do it at all. And we're telling them on the phone, we're not the droids you're looking for, right? You don't want to use this software for your problem. And they refuse to hear that. No, you don't understand. I'm trying to do this. Like, no, you're not listening to me. This isn't a word processor, you know? It's just bizarre because you're just talking past each other and like you cannot convince them that they shouldn't be talking to you. But they found a human, so goddamn it, they're not going to let go.
You know what? Because I talk to so many entrepreneurs, when I put in and so many businesses, when I put my phone number online, anyone who wants to reach those businesses ends up thinking that I'm somehow associated with them and they call me to talk to them. Right. I'll give you a great example. Back in the early days, I had my phone number up and I did an event with YellowBot. They're an online Yellow Pages company. Anyone who wanted to be in YellowBot.com or have their small business taken out of YellowBot.com couldn't find a number on their website, so they called me. And they would blame me for not being able to solve their problem. Why would your number be associated with them if you're not connected with them? I don't know. I didn't even realize my number was.
That's really funny. But you know, the bottom line is if you start getting a lot of weird phone calls, you just take it down. It's not that hard. You just stop, right? Get an 800 number so that you can redirect it or turn it off if you want and still have your local number or nothing. Or use Google Voice. So you know, there's lots and lots of ways of having kind of a throwaway number that you can disconnect if you don't want to do that anymore. That's all.
Balsamic Ball saying that I agree 100% that tech support is often the first, sometimes only time customers talk to us. Don't tell Peldy, the founder of the company, but I like to talk to customers. I can get lonely working from home at a UISV. I get it. I hate talking on the phone. I've got a number from Grasshopper, and one of the good things about it is that it helps route calls, so hopefully you don't end up with as many calls as you would if it was just a Google Voice number or cell phone number. But still, I'm reluctant to talk. I wish that I could talk to my mother by email.
Yeah, it's true.
All right. Let me ask you about what you're doing at Capital Factory. What does it mean to be a mentor at Capital Factory?
Sure. So Capital Factory is a seed stage incubator program, kind of like Y Combinator or Techstars.
I'm sorry, I'm just interrupting you just to clear up what I was saying earlier. Micro ISV, she's saying. The U was a typo. So sorry.
Oh, yeah.
So Capital Factory is?
Yeah, it's a seed stage. So there's seed money and mentorship for startups. And it's just like, it's similar to Y Combinator or Techstars. In fact, at the seed panel at South by Southwest, the representatives were us from Capital Factory and Techstars and Y Combinator and Naval from Venture Hacks with his AngelList stuff. So the idea is you get 20 grand in investment money, you get a whole bunch of services that are not crap, like a lawyer does all your paperwork, a designer can do all your website stuff, you get free office space for a while, you get free server hosting for a while, real stuff. Real valuable stuff. And the big thing is there's a 10-week summer program where 20 mentors, so people like me who have done startups before, you work one-on-one with them as well as some group meetings, and we bring in speakers. And so there's like just a whole pile of stuff where you get to directly interact with people who have done this before. So that's one of the interesting aspects of this program, which differentiates itself from some of the other ones, in that to be a mentor, you have created a company yourself and grown it, you know, to millions of dollars, probably sold. That's not a requirement. It could just be going, but most of them have also gone through that process as well. So really dealing with people who have done this at least once before. Also, the big money, we'll raise money, you know, X money is our money. So
it's kind of funky what's going on with Skype today. So it was coming in slow, and then suddenly everything that we'd missed came in all at once, and it was like you just at double speed. So you were weird. Telling us about who was involved in it as a mentor, and then you moved on to the next part, and I missed that.
Oh, okay, sorry. So a mentor has to be someone who started their own company.
Yep.
And made millions of dollars at it.
Yep.
Probably sold it, not necessarily. So they've been there before. They're not just, I have an MBA, so I'm going to tell you how to do a business. Also, the mentors put up all the money. So we are literally personally invested in all the companies. And so again, that kind of gives us an extra, I wouldn't say it makes us work harder than other people. Like everybody wants everyone to succeed, of course, but it just sort of shows that we're really in this. So last year was our first year, was really successful. Some of the companies got funded after the 10-week program, which is really fast. This year, we have another group of five companies, really excited about them. And the summer program is starting up in a couple of weeks, but we've already made the final selection. So this year, that's over. But next year, we're probably going to time our selection process to match Techstars and Y Combinator, meaning like the early April timeframe, I believe. Maybe don't quote me on that, though. But we want to try to get all the timings aligned.
Okay. How are you different than those two other programs?
Well, that's one of them, using our own money and the one-on-one direct interactions. And we're in Austin. I mean, one of the things is that, each of them are in a particular place and don't accept people from other places. And so just the fact that we're in Austin is a thing. Also, we have a pretty broad range of what kinds of companies we'll accept. So in other words, it's not true that every company needs to be a potentially $500 million idea. Some of the companies that come in should be funded and should go for something like that. Some of them should never take on funding and should bootstrap. I say bootstrap because, taking on a seed amount of money is still bootstrapping, but should not take on any funding and don't need massive exits like that. And they should do that and either become cash machines or, sell out for what I think is still really big, but small from a VC's point of view type of exit. And not all the programs have that view. A lot of them want to go big. Also, we're a little bit interested in what's hot. So like one of the companies we selected has to do with mobile geolocation stuff because that's super hot. But that's not our only criteria. In fact, that's probably the only one that's in a so-called super hot space that everyone's talking about because we're, again, maybe because we're less interested in raising money all the time and more interested in just having really quality companies. Another interesting thing just to throw it out there, and I wouldn't necessarily say this is differentiates us actually, but interesting fact. Generally, we're more interested in the team than the original idea. We're more interested in a team that we believe can execute stuff and who is introspective, who go out and experiment and say, look, we tried this and we failed. So now we're going to try this. That's way better than someone who says, we're sure this is going to work, right? So the ability to learn, the demonstrable ability to learn, and of course, just really good at what they do, innate talent is more important to us than the idea. The ideas can change. In fact, from last year, several of the ideas changed quite a bit. And in fact, Sparefoot, the company that not only got funded, but is just going absolutely like gangbusters right now, their idea changed pretty drastically from the beginning of the 10-week program to the end. In a good way, because it was all based on, not only mentor feedback, but them probing thing, probing the market and discovering what had traction.
What's
So
the
we're looking
big
for people.
advice that you have to repeat over and over to entrepreneurs who you're mentoring?
Well, they are, you hear nowadays fail fast. That's you hear it so many times it's boring, right? That's true, but in practice, people still really don't want to let go of their pet ideas. Similarly, they don't want to even go see if their idea is right. So, in other words, you hear get outside the building, and you need validated learning, and you need to talk to everyone first, and all that. Like you hear that a million times. If you read any blogs about startups, you've heard this 800 times. You're bored, right? Nevertheless, almost none of the hundreds of applications to Capital Factory this year, almost none of them said, and I have 10 people who say they'll give me money if I build this. Almost zero. So on the one hand, I feel like this concept has been beat to death and I'm almost bored of repeating it. On the other hand, I don't see people doing it. So I guess gotta repeat it again.
Interesting. Okay. Actually, then how do you convince them? Because when it's easy when we're listening to you say this to accept that it's true. It's easy when we're hearing somebody do an interview on Mixergy who says that he fought forever for this one idea and he probably should have let it go 6 months ago. It's easy to say, I could see, he should have really given it up. But when we're going through it and it's our own product and it's our own mission, I think it's a lot harder. I think then we start to say, well, if only I just tweak it a little bit, or maybe you don't understand what I'm trying to do. Or
yeah,
maybe
that's a good
something
point.
Else.
So here's what I would say. The reason that you don't want to go get the data is, number one, you're afraid of being wrong. And number two, it's the hard, yucky thing that isn't why you want to do a business anyway. When I say you, I'm thinking you're probably a technical entrepreneur. You're the person who's going to write the code. What you'd rather do all day long is stay in the compiler, write really cool code, maybe talk to customers about code. But that's probably more fun for you than AdWords. It's definitely more fun for you than accounting. And so because writing code is what you like and you're good at and what gets you excited and what you want to work on till 2 a.m, then you just automatically do that, even if that's not best for the business. And it's not only that it's not best for it, but it's also you're increasing your risk. And so here's an analogy that I think if you're a programmer, you can really, like me, you can really get behind. So if you're doing a big project, like it's going to be a 6-month project, what do you do with all the risky, unknown, undefined stuff? You tackle it first. You don't spend the first 3 or 4 months doing all of the stuff that you know how to do. It's just a matter of work. And then leave all the really crazy unknown crap for the end. Of course not. The first thing to do to reduce overall project risk is to take the worst, undefined, scariest crap you know the least about that has the most warts, and you tackle it first so that you can plan the rest of the stuff around it. Right? We all know that. So to me, this is what's going on with you. Just take one step back, and it's exactly the same thing with your business. And now the stuff that you know you can do is all of the software, all of it. You're going to make a pretty decent program. You know it's going to work. It's going to have few enough bugs. You can do that. We all know that. That's not where the risk is. The risk is that no one's ever going to find out about it. The risk is that no one's actually going to give you money for it. That's where the risk in your business is, not whether you can write code. You can. So what you're doing is you're making the same mistake. You're doing all the easy, unrisky stuff at first, and then you're still going to have to do that other stuff. You're still going to have to find people to buy it. You're still going to have to do that. But now you've put it at the end, and now you're going to waste effort, obviously. And it's just, you're in the heat of the moment, you don't want to do it. Like, number one, that's the macro level reason why it's wrong. So I'd like to hear the argument against that. And number two, you quit your day job, you're burning your savings, you're putting your reputation on the line. Like, other people are looking at you to see whether you're going to succeed. You're doing all of this stuff, you're taking on all the stress, you're working harder than you ever have, all without knowing whether anyone will ever even give you money. Like, that just doesn't make sense. The only reason why you're doing this is because you're afraid of it, which is totally valid. It's totally valid. But I think even if you're in the moment, how can you argue again? So that's my key.
How can you do that? How can you find out whether someone will actually give you money for a product before it's even built? Take Patrick McKenzie, for example. He's the guy who created BingoCardCreator.com. Now he's got a new site. I forget what it's called, but it's about helping you make appointments, or helping the people who make appointments with you.
Well, of course, it's easier to build something first. It's just the wrong choice.
Find someone who's going to pay him for it.
It's easier for me to not brush my teeth every day.
They're willing to pay for it.
But that doesn't make it smart just because it's easier. Well, so
here's
my argument.
Isn't
it easier
to create something and then see if anyone comes and then figure out how to get people to
come? You can't find 10 people who say they'll buy it. By the way, they don't have to actually buy it.
No.
I didn't say they have to give you credit cards or purchase orders. Just claim they'll buy it. It's okay if they don't actually. But if you can't even find 10 people who say that they would buy such a thing, then let's say you did build it. Well, how are you going to find the first 10 customers? Isn't it the same problem? I mean, the only difference now is you have screens that work instead of screenshots that are mocked up. That's the only difference, except you've wasted all this effort and if it's not true that they want it. So, if you can't describe it to your target audience in 30 seconds and have them go, that sounds pretty interesting. Yeah, let me know when you build that. If you can't do that, what makes you think you can do it once it's built? You're still going to be at a cocktail party and you're still going to give your 30-second pitch and you won't have your demo handy. And they still need to say that sounds really useful, or else you don't have a product, right? So there's no reason why you can't do 30-second pitches of your idea to people, or maybe mock-ups or whatever. You know, there's various like prototype type things that don't involve writing the whole thing. And if you can't distill it into 30 seconds in such a way that people are interested, or if you can't find those people, like you say, well, I don't know how to find 10 people. Okay, again, if you don't know how to find 10 people today, okay, you also have a website that no one's heard of. Now how are you going to find 10 people? It's the same problem.
I see.
And again, you might as well address that risk, which is the riskiest part, first.
Somebody here in the chat, Michael Rakowski in the chat, put up the website. It's called appointment, appointmentreminder.org. I see. So at the very least, what you suggest is that he calls up the dentist who he hopes will use it and say, if I bill this, is this something you guys would want to pay for? Or call up the hair salons who might want to use this and ask them that question. And maybe the answer that he'll hear back is, no, we already have a system in place. We just don't like to use it. And that's an interesting answer. Or maybe they'll say, absolutely, but it has to also interact with the Mac because we're all into Macs or whatever their issue might be.
Sure.
All right. Yeah. Sorry, a lot of people in the chat room are also asking about single founders. You are a single founder, right?
That's true.
So what's your take today after having gone through it yourself on single founders?
In the future, I probably won't do it again. But also I'm in a different place in my life now where I have a kid and other things where I want to share a lot of those burdens regardless. I think, you hear things like, more likely for two people to succeed. I mean, there's no doubt that on the plus side, there's more people working. It really is double the work with double the people if it's two like super committed founders, right? And there's an infinite amount to do in a startup, so it's not the mythical mammoth. It is like completely parallel things to do, and that's really valuable. And then to prop each other up when times are bad really helps. But every time you hear a story like that, you hear another story about founders breaking up. And some the end when there's a lot of money involved, and so you don't, it really is that's still bad. But a lot of times it's not. A lot of times a company dissolves because there were three people and one of them leaves and it's a three-legged stool and it doesn't stand. And so the company fails because you had a partner.
Yeah.
And it absolutely happens at least as much times as you hear the success stories where it was valuable to have it. So I think at the end of the day, I don't think one or the other is automatically better. And so it's more, I think, of a personal choice. For me, I know that, yes, I'm a control freak. No, I don't necessarily work well with others. And so for me, the single founder thing was kind of okay. At the same time, I had mentors that I could lean on. So that's pretty nice. If I didn't have that, then what? So, that can change it. So I would say, somewhat look within. and finally, I think if you can get a diverse set of founders, so if there's like the person who you really do trust with sales and marketing, the person that can be nose deep in the compiler, that's pretty powerful. Watchdogs, before I did SmartBear, I was part of a three-legged stool. There was me, the software guy, Jerry, whose idea it was, and the salesman and the marketing guy, and Michael, the double E guy, because this was hardware with embedded software. And it worked really, really well. And it's not like the lines were strictly drawn. I went on a ton of sales calls and I loved it. It's not that you have titles and you're drawing curtains, not at all. But just that there's someone who, when they wake up in the morning till they go to sleep at night, they're thinking about a certain set of things, at least, right? And it was extremely productive, and I'm pretty sure that the thing would not have worked had it not been for that. So especially when there's expertise like that. In other words, two software developer founders versus three software developer founders, three is better, I suppose, but like you're not giving yourself a whole lot more advantage there. Whereas if you're picking up other skills, that's super powerful.
Brendan in the audience is asking, will Capital Factory accept single founders? Because he says a lot of similar programs don't want that.
That's right. Paul Graham is very vocal about not accepting single founders. We do not have that problem. Single founders are fine. So here's the criteria, though. Mm-hmm. We don't want there to be a hole in the team in which The hole is so big that we have to fill it before you can even start the 10-week program, because then it's a hiring problem. And you know how hiring is. You can't just decide you're going to hire a really good person in the next 2 weeks. That's not how you hire good people, right? That's you don't get to do that. So in fact, one of the companies we picked is a single founder. So there is proof for you that, yes, we accept that, but it has to be someone who's an omnibus, or, you know, maybe it's a situation where you don't need someone to do some of these other things. So for example, maybe a product, well, a lot of products, in my opinion, do not require a sales force. So therefore, you don't need a salesperson, and that's not a member of the team we care about. But, you know, of course, there are products that do require someone hitting, you know, getting in the car and making sales calls. So if we were to accept someone like that, someone, you know, and it was just a single founder and someone had to build stuff and someone had to be on the road, for example, like that wouldn't work if you didn't have that team. So
all right,
it's harder for a single founder to have all those attributes at once. But, you know, again, we did it this year. So there you go.
All right. And that website is just capitalfactory.com, right?
Right.
Of course, if anyone wants to read your blog, asmartbear.com, asmartbear.com. And thank you for being here, Jason. Thanks for doing the interview with me.
This is a bunch of fun. Thanks.
Cool. I hope this won't be the last one. And guys, thanks for watching. I'm Andrew. I'll see you on the website.